one-hour program. I was used to live TV, and we'd just basically flown by the seat of our pants on the Food Network. Here we did too, but the hurry-up and wait of it all was insane. Since then, we've gotten much better at streamlining the show, but things can still get... well, they can still take a while. We were shooting at UCLA, and I remember thinking how nice it was that my husband could finally come to see me working. But watching a TV show being made isn't all it's cracked up to be, and he soon got bored and went back to the hotel. Things were going really well for me professionally, and I started feeling better about myself. Just as I was convinced my days appearing in magazines were over, Newsweek called to tell me they wanted to put me on their cover to go with a story about the, quote, new India. I was totally thrilled and could not believe it. I got off the phone and ran upstairs to tell Salman. He was at his desk as usual, and I crawled up onto his lap. The moment I looked into his face and uttered the news, some knee-jerk reaction inside me braced for his reply. Lately, any time I had some good news about my professional life, it seemed to interfere somehow with us. He just said, "That's great. I'm happy for you." The only time Newsweek put me on their cover was when someone was trying to put a bullet in my head. I didn't know how to react. I didn't want to anger him by saying the wrong thing or overreacting. I just wanted him to be proud of me. For us to savor this moment together. I hoped he was indeed glad for me, if only because of how happy it made me. He seemed irked in some barely perceptible way. Lately, we hadn't been getting along as well. I couldn't shake the feeling I wasn't meeting his expectations as a wife. Indeed, at times he had told me as much. And I began to replace my insecurity about work with insecurity about my marriage. On top of this discord, my menstrual cramps had worsened more and more over the last few years. I had always had pain every month and was used to taking a lot of pain medication during that time, but recently I felt the effects longer and more severely. During these times, I did not want to make love or be intimate in any way, and I actually found it hard to sleep because of my chronic pain. Plus, I was a light sleeper, and my husband snored. And that had gotten worse over the years, too. I had been in pain for more than 2 decades. It started on the morning of my 13th birthday with my first period. The dark liquid, thick and oozing from me, heralded almost immediately a lifelong companion. Cramping, pain, a numbing ache. It wasn't very strong at first. I was distracted from the onslaught of my burgeoning womanhood, I guess. The hair that grew between my legs and in my armpits, the newly puffy nipples, and a general awkwardness were as difficult to accept. Pain had not been totally unexpected anyway. My own mother had primed me for what lay ahead. "Some girls get it and some girls don't. It's just our lot in life. Part of being a woman," she said. I had seen her miss work because of her own monthly pain. Seen her take pills and lie with heating pads and hot water bottles. Throughout my adolescence, the pain grew in intensity and duration, as did the flow of blood from my deepest insides. In college, I begged my roommate to drive to the all-night pharmacy on Route 9 at midnight when I needed to retrieve more pain medication that the doctor had prescribed. I became moody during what seemed like a third of the month and wondered if I would suffer from intermittent bouts of depression, as my mother had started to during my high school years. Soon I began to have pain not only during that 1 week in the month I bled, but also while ovulating. I could tell which ovary produced the egg to be expelled that month just by where the pain emanated from. Along with cramping, bloating, and a general achy malaise, I began to feel my whole pelvis go numb. And at times, I also had lower back pain and a pain that could shoot down one leg. I suffered severe nausea and headaches, too, though I couldn't tell if they were from my period or from the various pharmaceuticals to quell what was blandly referred to as menstrual discomfort or dysmenorrhea. No doctor seemed to know why. Nothing had eased my condition for long. One day, 9 months before Salman and I separated, I was at a studio, shooting the photos for my second cookbook. There's a photo of me by a window, looking out onto the Bowery. In it, I look contemplative and happy, pretty. In the real world, I was realizing I had started bleeding and was hoping against hope the blood wouldn't leak through my underwear and onto my clothing. I hadn't brought tampons. I was 2 weeks into my cycle, so that afternoon I stuffed my underwear with tissue. My family doctor was already worried. He knew I'd have problems connected with my period and sent me to see a specialist on the Upper East Side. The day of the appointment was a hectic one. I rose at 5 that October morning to do an early cooking segment on the Today Show. The day included, among other things, a work lunch, meetings with both my editor and a group of buyers about the release of my new cookbook, and an early dinner at Bergdorf Goodman. I squeezed in my appointment just after running home to change and just before the dinner. When I hailed a cab to the doctor's office, I had on a shiny, strapless Marquesa cocktail dress, embroidered with large cranes and flowers in gold, green, and magenta thread. The bird's wings and eyes twinkled with little sequins. My TV makeup from the morning had faded in nicely, and in the car I touched up my lipstick so I would be ready to dash to the dinner afterward. In the office, I took a seat across from the doctor at his desk, feeling silly for being so overdressed. The doctor, Tamer Sechkin, came in and asked me a series of very thorough questions, almost too personal, even for a medical doctor. How are your sexual relations with your husband? How has your libido dwindled over the years you have been together? Doesn't everyone's? What is your emotional and mental state during the week of your period? Do you have gas? Constipation? Do you ever argue about sex? Do your bra and pant sizes change within a month? Do you become irritable inexplicably? Have your period and the surrounding symptoms ever been an issue for your professional or home life? Do you feel understood? I was taken aback. He asked me to don a papery gown and meet him in the exam room. When I stripped down, I noticed deep red grooves imprinted on my torso from the dress's corset. In my effort to multitask the day, I hadn't thought things through. I wondered if he would think me so superficial that I was willing to constrict myself in the garment so extremely in order to look good. But surely he had seen a corset or two in his time. I felt embarrassed in front of this doctor, and not solely because of my nakedness. Yet I didn't completely understand why. The nurse held my hand, and Sechkin wielded what I learned later was a pediatric speculum. I squeezed her hand to fight the pain. He performed 2 exams, one that I had never had before. He did a rectal exam. No one who had ever examined me in all my 36 years had ever performed that exam. No gynecologist had ever been so invasive, physically or otherwise. After he finished, he asked me to get dressed and meet him in his office. The clock above his head read 6:52 p.m. I had a dinner to get to. "Will this take long, doctor?" I asked. "Yes, Miss Lakshmi, it might." Sonograms and speculums can see beyond even the most sincere smile, the most glamorous cocktail dress. Sitting across from Dr. Sechkin, I heard the word endometriosis for the first time. Over the course of the last 20 years, I had dutifully gone for checkups. I had seen doctors, and specifically gynecologists of both sexes in various countries around the world. All of them were fine with prescribing pain pills for regular consumption and reiterated what my mother had said when I first found out about the atrocities my body was capable of in the name of womanhood. "Yes, for some women, it's a lifelong curse," they echoed. No one indicated that what was happening was serious or damaging long-term or anything like that. Some doctors thought I was exaggerating. Others became irate, including a woman who insisted that it couldn't hurt that much while she pushed her cold metal speculum inside me. I flinched, wincing in pain. One doctor actually smoked during the exam in Milan. I minded the smoker much less, especially since he at least put me on birth control, which did help for a time during my 20s. I had quit using birth control a few months after my husband and I first moved in together, just around my turning 30. Spending my 20s under the influence of hormones was enough, and I could see the side effects taking their toll on my skin. I had also spent most of that time as a smoker, and that had preyed on my mind too. Now, at the age of 36, my body, unbeknownst to me, had been going full tilt for 6 years, producing excess tissue it could not expel at a much more rapid rate than in my 20s, when I was on contraceptive hormones to suppress the disease and its effects. A healthy female body, Sechkin explained, expels uterine lining during menstruation. Not so in the case of a woman who has endometriosis. Instead, the tissue pools in the body's reproductive cul-de-sac. The body then reabsorbs the lining, which grows. But the lining is no mere plasma or scar tissue. It has glands and responds to hormones, forming layer upon layer in the uterus, a new one each month that spills out into the peritoneum, or lower abdomen. It can pool outside the uterus and attach itself to all the internal organs of a woman with the condition, preventing normal functioning of those organs. It can choke her reproductive system, as weeds in a healthy garden can take down the tallest of shrubs. It can cause gastrointestinal problems, and often is misdiagnosed by gastroenterologists, as had happened to me just months before in April. It can bring your house down with pain, excruciating pain that is ever present during the most normal functions of everyday life. It is very dangerous to the physical, mental, and emotional well-being of a patient, as well as the general well-being of her whole family. I had gotten my period 23 years earlier, a present from puberty that seemed like a bad joke that September morning. Now, decades later, on this evening, I sat in Dr. Sechkin's office, hearing for the very first time that I had a disease called endometriosis, which could threaten my fertility. I had just turned 36. For 20 years, this powerful tissue had amassed and twined itself inside me, growing outward from my uterus, spreading through my body and coiling around my insides. It felt like it had choked and mutilated every part of my being. I wasn't crazy or dramatic, and I didn't have a low threshold for pain. In fact, I probably had a high threshold for pain, and that may have been part of the problem. Dr. Sechkin didn't understand why I wasn't writhing in pain outside his office. "I believe you when you say you think you have answered my questions honestly and sincerely," he pronounced very deliberately in his strong Turkish accent. "But what I see of your anatomy and the picture you are painting of your life seem very different." So much was suddenly so clear. Just months before, in April, on our second wedding anniversary, I'd had to be rushed to the hospital late at night. The tissue had wrapped itself like a tourniquet around my small intestines, though I hadn't known then what was really happening. I'd been in pain all day, but didn't want to disappoint Salman, who had reserved a table at Boulay weeks before. To his credit, he suggested we stay home, but I wanted to celebrate with him. We both needed a good time together. I knew, too, that he expected to make love, something I wasn't sure I was capable of. Until recently, we had always been hungry for each other and could never get enough. Lately, though, we had been fighting more and more about our lack of intimacy. I figured that after the meal and a bottle of red, he might tire out, or better yet, I might feel better. My plan wasn't very well thought out. The chef insisted on us having the tasting menu, something that happened a lot lately because of my job on TV. A third of the way through, I asked the maitre d' for a pillow. My lower back was throbbing, and the pain was wrapping around to my abdomen, which was cramping, too. I thought the pillow might give me some support, or that I could find a more comfortable position leaning against it. Each course the waiter brought, my pain increased. I barely made it through the meal. When we got home, I climbed up the stairs to the fourth floor, Halfway up, I began to have trouble breathing and stumbled. I made it to our bedroom, tore off my red jersey dress, and reached for the heating pad, which was always plugged in and waiting under my pillow. I turned on my side and doubled over. My husband came in, and I told him that in addition to the back pain, I had begun cramping and that it really hurt. And I didn't know why. "Of course," he said. "How convenient for you. It's not your period, and it's not your ovulation. What is it this time?" This didn't sound quite as cruel at the time as it seems now, hearing it. For years I had tried hard to hide my pain from others, even from him, and to dull my symptoms through denial and keeping busy. My mother, from a very early age, told me what her mother had told her, that this was just our lot in life. She said that the only thing to do was to try very hard not to let it affect any more of my life than it had to. So I compartmentalized the pain, tried to mostly sequester myself in bed until it subsided enough that I could get up. Now I understand that we were both feeling the effects of this vexing disease. To this day, my mother hasn't been officially diagnosed, but she's suffered the same mysterious pain, the same stab-in-the-dark surgeries. One doctor, ignorant of the cause of her suffering, threw up his hands and wound up removing her appendix. My husband never truly grasped the extent of my pain, in part because I took it for granted. Now Dr. Sutchkin was telling me that I probably had pain during sex. I wasn't sure this was true. For the first several years together, our intimacy was fully gratifying. I don't ever remember having pain during sex. But I'd gotten so used to all the other pain that I didn't even identify it as pain anymore. Recently, I could remember my husband complaining that I rarely wanted to make love. And when I did, it was only after we had been drinking. He said he kept a diary about it. He felt justifiably rejected. I asked Dr. Sutchkin to call my husband and explain the disease's particulars, which I was only just beginning to understand. Coming from the doctor, I thought the information would be less charged, more empirical. Then my husband would have to understand that I wasn't just making excuses. Yet my need for reinforcements, though I didn't understand it at the time, reflected a rift in our relationship that grew ever wider. Now, after just 2 years of marriage and 7 living together, our intimacy was fraught. I began to feel lonely, isolated by my pain. I started to feel happier, or more appropriately, less unhappy, when he wasn't around. In his presence, I felt as though I wasn't measuring up, and I was letting him down if I didn't do or go where he wanted. By myself, I was free to wonder what was increasingly wrong with my body without being made to feel like I was exaggerating. I was free to wallow in my malaise and nurse myself without seeing the disappointment in his face. I needed to fully deal with what was happening to me. And I could only do that, it seemed, when I was alone. That night of our 2nd anniversary in April, he must have thought the pain I reported was in fact an equivalent to my saying, "I don't feel like it and I have to get up early." After a heated exchange of many words and much door slamming, he went to sleep in the room across the hall. Around midnight, I called an ambulance, and Salman accompanied me to Mount Sinai Hospital, where a gastroenterologist was waiting. Remember, this was before Sechkin's diagnosis. The doctors were still clueless. The doctor who operated that night was like a landscaper, snipping off a small, unsightly root. "It's just scar tissue, perhaps from your earlier surgery for ovarian cysts, but you should be fine now," he said, while a massive, gnarled system still lurked beneath my house, threatening to crack the foundation. Sure enough, in the weeks and months after the surgery, the pain resumed, and my husband became increasingly frustrated with me, and I became more and more worried, not only for my marriage, but also for my own body's health. Now, 6 months later, Dr. Sutchkin was telling me I wasn't crazy for not feeling like being intimate. He said every fiber of my being would be repelled by the idea of intimacy because of what was going on in my reproductive system and with my hormones. In fact, I am surprised you walked into my office on 2 feet, he said. I started to cry. I remember worrying for a second about ruining my makeup. In the car, inching its way down Fifth Avenue toward Bergdorf Goodman and this glamorous party, I looked back on my past with a new understanding. This sickness, this endo-whatever, had stained so much. My sense of self, my womanhood, my marriage, my ability to be present. I had effectively missed 1 week of each month every year of my life since I was 13. Because of the chronic pain and hormonal fluctuations I suffered during my period. I had lain in bed with heating pads and hot water bottles, using acupuncture, drinking teas, taking various pain medications, and suffering the collateral effects of them. I thought of all the many tests I missed in various classes throughout my education, the school dances, the jobs I knew I couldn't take as a model, because of the bleeding and bloating as well as the pain, especially the bathing suit and lingerie shoots, because those paid the most. How many family occasions was I absent from? How many second or third dates had I not gone on? How many times had I not been able to be there for others, or for myself? How many of my reactions to stress or emotional strife had been colored through the lens of this chronic pain? My sense of self was defined by this handicap, the impediment of expected pain would shackle my days and any plans I ever made. I did not see my own womanhood as something positive or to be celebrated, but as a curse that I had to constantly make room for and muddle through. Like the scar on my arm, my reproductive system was a liability. The disease, developing part and parcel with my womanhood, starting at puberty, with my menses, affected my own self-esteem and the way I felt about my body. No one likes to get her period, but when your femininity carries with it such pain and consistent physical and emotional strife, it's hard not to feel that your body is betraying you. The very relationship you have with yourself and your person is tainted by these ever-present problems. I now, finally, knew my struggles were due to this condition. I wasn't high-strung or fickle, and I wasn't overreacting. All my life, I had had the sense that something was wrong and couldn't put my finger on it. I had seen college roommates pop 2 ibuprofen pills and skip off to basketball practice with no problems when they had their periods. I always wondered what was wrong with me. Why did I have such trouble dealing with one of the most basic and common functions Mother Nature handed all women? I heard my mother's voice echo in my head. Because I had it, Batty, and your grandmother had it. That's just what happens. In my mother's generation, they would just take out all your plumbing if it got really bad. But now, we can treat it with laparoscopic surgery, excise this problematic tissue and expel it from the body, said Sechkin. I am surprised you slipped through the cracks without any treatment this long. If he was surprised, I was flabbergasted. I had dutifully gone to my gynecological checkups, and not one doctor had ever brought up this disease. I even had 2 ovarian cysts removed at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center, where my Beverly Hills gynecologist had said that one of my cysts was, quote, endometrionic, or blood-filled. But he never said the words, you have endometriosis. It is a condition that needs to be treated and monitored. It is a serious condition that can and will not only endanger your health and the proper function of your internal organs, all of them, but will also affect your fertility. In fact, endometriosis is one of the 3 major causes of infertility in women, and at least 10% of all women worldwide suffer from it. As I reached the dinner, I tried to stuff back all the emotions that had bubbled up, just as I'd stuffed away from view the pain and discomfort for all these many years. Just like I struggled to fit all my cosmetics back into the small evening bag after I dabbed and patched my face back together. The car door opened. A red carpet. A flashbulb went off. I hopped out of the car and fixed a smile on my face. At dinner, there were toasts and cheers as we looked out over Central Park. the first of the blue night stars visible above the bony trees and the fallen autumn leaves. 3 weeks later, on the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, Dr. Sechkin performed his first surgery. I picked the day in the hope I could recuperate over the long weekend without anyone knowing I'd been out of commission. At first, he guessed the surgery would take an hour and a half, and I'd be home the next morning and back at my desk by Monday. I awoke to the sound of my own voice. I smelled the faint odor of mustard seeds and ginger. In the darkness of the hospital room, my mother, two aunts, an uncle, and various cousins kept vigil, leaning or sitting on every surface and quietly nibbling food from round tin containers. Top Chef was on the TV. There was a Thanksgiving marathon. Dr. Sechkin came to speak to me in the recovery room after surgery was over. In my anesthetized haze, I heard him say that my right fallopian tube had been rendered functionless from the buildup of endometriosis tissue. He asked if I knew that part of my left ovary had been removed during a previous operation. Incredibly, I didn't. I learned the surgery had taken 4.5 hours, that my kidneys were in stents, that I had stitches on 4 major organs, and that of the 19 biopsies performed, 17 came back positive as deeply infiltrating endometriosis tissue, also known as DIE, or DIE. Rather than an overnight stay, I spent 5 days in the hospital. 24 hours after my discharge, my husband had to leave for a trip. "The show must go on, after all," he said. My aunt Neela, who had flown in from India, and my mother, who had come from Los Angeles, cared for me. Something they had done at different times throughout my life. Over the next 2.5 months, as I lay bedridden on the top floor of our brownstone, they took turns, flying in and out. As they tended to me, my husband toiled in his office below, where great literature was being born. Over those many weeks, on my back, staring at a white ceiling, I had ample time to think. There was nothing to distract me. No work I could do, or ways to keep busy. Now the thoughts that had exploded like little bombs in my head as I drove down Fifth Avenue that inky fall evening could no longer be muffled. All those hours and days and weeks staring at that ceiling, looking back, revealed a new perspective on my years with Salman. Early on, we were so full of passion, even when we fought, which we did quite a lot over matters both large and very small, I took it as evidence of the intensity of our love. He would slam doors and storm out, snatching a pillow from our bed and dramatically decamping to another room. He said his piece, I think. He'll cool off by morning. Then I'd hear his fast footsteps trudging on our creaky wood floor, and he'd charge back in, like a rhinoceros on its hind legs. I found these heated exchanges challenging and difficult. I had heard enough bad-tempered yelling from my stepdad in high school to last me a lifetime. I no longer wanted that as part of my life. Nor did it help that my husband argued with the same lethal eloquence he had used to woo me. Of course, just because a point is well made doesn't mean it's right. I was articulate enough, but I couldn't compete rhetorically. After a while, I was simply defiant. Passion can come from many places, including but not limited to love. I don't doubt he loved me, nor do I doubt that what seemed like a desire for me was also in part a desire for what I provided, an adoring audience. Few people could resist his charm, the way he dominated a dinner party and made you glad you were there to listen. This made him a glorious friend and party companion. But after a party, everyone goes home. Me? I went home with him. I was the full-time live-in audience. As is the case with many creative people, his ego needed frequent tending. He is, without a doubt, a brilliant man and a great artist. Yet somehow he lacked self-awareness. And tellingly, a sense of humor about himself. Every October, when the Nobel Prize winners were announced, he became moody and a bit irritable. He was certain he was noble as ob, And every year I'd comfort him, cooing, "Of course you deserve it." And, "Oh, they don't know what they're doing." I did feel he deserved it, and the disappointment understandably cut him deeply. But then he'd say, "Yes, yes, many great artists never get the Nobel," continuing on to list, without irony, those writers, Proust, Joyce. My attention was proof of my devotion, and my devotion was a balm for his insecurities. At first, I was grateful to be the object of such intense desire. Yet what's flattering in the first year can be suffocating in the eighth. I thought marriage might prove to him that I wasn't going anywhere. To be fair, my husband didn't change during the 8 years we were together. I knew what I was getting into. I think, however, that I changed, as do many women between 28 and 36. And because I'd been a model enjoying 6 or so years of surreal, carefree existence, I think my 20s had been a sort of extended adolescence. When we met, he was already the man he'd always be. At 28, I was still becoming myself. Perhaps I didn't voice my unhappiness soon enough. Rather, I spent more time feeling like a disappointment and scrambling to patch our cracks than I did considering whether he required an unreasonable level of tending. The tension grew worse as my work prospects grew brighter, and I became, I guess, less portable. No longer could I be on his arm at every dinner, every premiere, or every tribute. I had a second book coming out, was hosting Top Chef, and had addressed the UN in support of the organization then called UNIFEM that advocated for women. Those achievements were my own, and I was proud of them. Maybe they didn't compare to his. All that time in bed and the locus of my sickness brought another matter into focus. I had never really decided whether I wanted children. Early on, Salman told me he didn't want to have another child. After all, he already had two. This made me wonder whether our relationship had legs. Ultimately, though, he relented. For me, he'd be open to it, and so I felt comfortable, agreeing, when one day we rolled out of bed after almost 5 years together, and he wondered aloud, "Maybe we should get married." "Salman, are you asking me to marry you?" I asked. "Yes. Will you marry me?" he said. Our honeymoon included a red carpet event in Cannes, my first, to help out his son Zafar, who was doing PR there, and then a stop in Barcelona so he could give a speech. I was immune then to what this rather unromantic detour portended, and I didn't mind so much. I'd have said so if I did. What mattered was that we were together. As we walked the carpet, I watched the mass of photographers falling over one another as flashes flashed and shutters clicked with a constancy that produced a sound like an infestation of some strange insect trying to attract mates. I was no naive at the time, no stranger to the spotlight or the paparazzi. I had paraded down the runway in a bikini. I had co-hosted a live TV show. Yet, for some reason now, with cameras going off like automatic weapons, my worried thoughts, why are they taking so many photos, like nature photographers, trying to catch a hummingbird in flight, when we're standing still, became a physical presence. I couldn't breathe. Salman sensed something was wrong, and I found comfort in his hand, steady around my waist. For the next few years until we divorced, I had panic attacks on the red carpet. In these moments, I was captured being what I most feared I would become, an ornament or medal. I wasn't a model or a host, an actress or an advocate. I was wearing a sparkly dress and standing beside a great writer. I was worried, whether I knew it then or not, that without him, I would simply disappear. My laissez-faire attitude about motherhood began to change. The surgery brought a sense of urgency to my decision. If I did want kids, I would have to find out right away whether my body would even oblige. I'd also have to be sure I wanted to bring a child into this marriage. My husband was 59 then. Aside from the logistical complexities of our relationship, he traveled often, his children lived in London, With which family would he spend holidays if I couldn't travel, as had been the case, by the way, while I was bedridden? Then there was my unhappiness. I was a child of divorce, two times over. I dreaded my child having the same experience. Before the operation, we had somehow managed to piece and patch together the relationship with the putty of our love. But now I could no longer continue making those repairs. Even after the surgery, and all of Dr. Sechkin's talking to him, Salman didn't seem to grasp the disease's impact on me or on our marriage. He was absent, emotionally and often physically. The women in my family shepherded me through recovery and made sure I was never alone. I was left to grapple, however, with the most intimate effects, those that only a partner can know, by myself. I felt hollow, both in spirit and in body, my insides having been scalded, carved, and scraped out. I had been feeling guilty, like a bad wife for not wanting to make love. It was this issue that was the nucleus of much of the strife between my husband and me. It must have been hard for him, after experiencing the intensity of my passion for him for all those years, to be confronted with my ebbing desire, my diminished wellness of being, and the increased distraction of my work. But now the doctor had informed us both that there was a tangible medical reason for my waning libido. It wasn't my fault, and it didn't have anything to do with my love for him, which I had told him many, many times, even before my diagnosis. Lying there bedridden, I felt that my sexuality was even more eroded than before the operation. I looked outside our window, at the bare-limbed tree in the neighbor's backyard, stoic in northern light. I swam in an ocean of loneliness as I thought about my marriage and my future. I was drowning. That loneliness then turned into anger. What about in sickness and in health? What about, I'm so sorry I gave you such grief when you were very ill? What about, I'm sorry, I didn't believe you on our anniversary when the ambulance had to cart you away? What about those things? Now in retrospect, I can see how my husband suffered. The difference between two people who love each other as romantic partners and every other loving relationship is the sexual aspect of that union. At the time I had just received the information that my fertility was in peril, I had been feeling like I had let down my husband for over a year. My body had failed me, but it had also failed him. And we were arguing almost every time I chose to pursue my own work instead of accompany him for his. When I was finally well enough to leave the house, on my own two feet, I went to see a divorce lawyer. It was not an easy trip. And not just because of the pain biting at my belly. To seek a divorce was to admit failure. It was to accept that the doubts my friends and family expressed early on. He had been already married three times. How would a relationship between two people of such unequal stature and age and accomplishment be equal or even work out? Were warranted. It was to confront the possibility that when we parted ways, I might just disappear back into the relative obscurity from which I came. It was to tear my life in two, to leave the side of the man I had loved the most. Yet as always, my mother's story and will gave me hope. My mother Vijaya, her name means victory in Sanskrit, had survived much worse. When my husband returned from his Christmas holiday in London in January 2007, only to jet off again a few days later to the Jaipur Literature Festival. I told him I wanted a temporary separation. Well, he said, you can have one, but it won't be temporary. I told him I had seen a lawyer, and he replied, then there's really nothing to discuss. By that April, I had recovered from my surgery, finished my cookbook, and flown to Miami to film the third season of Top Chef. Salman and I had reconciled a month back, provisionally. I thought then that ours was the greatest love story of my life, and I couldn't bear to end it. We had agreed to work on our relationship. 3 weeks into filming, my husband would fly down to celebrate our third wedding anniversary. I looked forward to it. But first I had work to do. We had just finished a segment when I got word he had arrived and was waiting for me in the control room. "Thanks," I said. "Can you tell him I'm not done working so I can just have a quick cigarette?" I forgot I was still wearing my mic. Salman could clearly hear me on the monitors. I had quit smoking when we first moved in together. I'd failed many times before, but he suffered from asthma, and somehow it was easier to stop smoking for his health rather than my own. As our marriage started its painful undoing, I'd resumed the insidious habit, keeping it a secret from him. I didn't want to add my smoking to the growing list of ways I disappointed him. After a long day of shooting and in the midst of another painful period, I needed a minute just to myself and some noxious relief. I had both revealed my relapse and embarrassed him in front of my colleagues after he'd flown in all the way from New York, especially to see me. That night, when work wrapped, we fought. The row was exactly the same as the one we'd had a whole year earlier, after our anniversary dinner at Boulay, and just hours before I'd been carted away by ambulance. It was the same one we'd had so many times before, the same one that had once caused him to lash out, calling me a bad investment during another fight in London on New Year's Eve in front of a friend. He wanted what I couldn't give him. I didn't feel like being intimate, and his constant irascibility because of that fact made me want to even less. This time my empathy had waned. My guilty feelings about not performing my wifely duty outmatched by outrage. After all I'd been through medically, after all he'd seen, nothing had changed. I fought feelings of failure, as a woman and as a wife. Still, I knew, right then, I had to leave. I wasn't sure how we'd make the split public, an odd decision we had to consider. I was prepared to say we parted amicably. He never gave me the privilege of deciding. Salman Rushdie has agreed to divorce his wife, Padma Lakshmi, because of her desire to end their marriage, read the statement released by his literary agent. How businesslike. I was still in bed recovering from a subsequent endometriosis procedure at the end of June when a friend who had read the paper called to make sure I was okay. I had no idea any announcement had even been made. And so I was left with a mantra, a sort of haiku version of our relationship. I don't regret one day I spent with him. Nor did I leave a moment too soon. Chapter 3. I'd moved into the Sari Hotel over July 4th weekend, while Salman was in London to visit and bring back his son Milan. I wanted to get out before they returned to New York. Sweet little Milan. What would he think? Just a few years back, I had taught him to roller skate from our stoop so he could savor the city, as I had when I was younger. I hated the thought of him breathing in the toxic atmosphere of loss and anger that then existed between Salman and me in our home. I wanted to talk to my stepson, to tell him that I still loved him, and that my leaving his father was not intended as a rejection of him, that I would still be there, if and whenever he wanted me, if his parents allowed it. I didn't get the chance. When I asked if I could speak to him, I was told by Salman that when he informed Milan, "She is leaving us," Milan had said, "then I don't want to see her." Us? Who could blame a boy for siding with his father? Days before I left, Dr. Sechkin had performed yet another surgery, this one to excise the remaining endometriosis tissue that he wasn't able to remove during the first. I was gaunt. A cocktail of sadness and medication made me nauseous and sapped my appetite. The stale smell of picked-at sandwiches and barely touched haystacks of French fries lingering on room service trays didn't help. I had been at the Sari Hotel for over a month by this time. Gavin Kaysen, the chef at Café Boulud, had been instructed by Danielle Boulud to look after me, and they often sent up trays filled with every single dessert on the menu. It was a gallant and kind gesture, but did not restore my appetite. I knew the trick to eating well was to cook for myself, and to that end, I had selected this hotel room for its kitchenette. But I couldn't bear to turn on the stove. As thin as I was, I felt heavy and sluggish. I was paralyzed by sadness and self-doubt. Had I made a mistake getting married in the first place? Or had I given up too quickly? I had left a familiar unhappiness for a new, uncertain sort. I winced as I recalled my failings as a wife, and I imagined confronting the people whose smiling faces populated our wedding photos. I tried to envision a future without the companion with whom I had spent half of my adulthood, my hope for a happy life eroding with each memory of my beloved. Back on the floor, staring at those spilled kumquats scattered on the carpeting among the detritus of my life, I felt so inconceivably far from the days of intercontinental phone calls that reached deep into the night. I left because I couldn't stay. There had been no shortage of love, no infidelity. It was just a simple lack of empathy on both our parts. Racked by our own wounds and emotional fatigue, we could not soothe each other. And down we went, spiraling apart. I felt totally lost. Out to sea, waiting for my 37th birthday, childless, and now alone. I had to do something to cut through the grayness around me and the grayness inside. I picked up one of the kumquats and pressed my nail into its rind, releasing an aroma so faint I thought I'd imagined it. As a girl in Los Angeles, I made a game of stomping and squishing fallen kumquats as I walked to school. The kids on our block used to dare one another to eat them whole, plucked off the tree. Once in a while, one of us would take the dare, chomping down on the whole fruit, the sweet rind giving way to an explosion of bracingly sour pulp and the bitterness of broken seeds. Now, here in the hotel room, I licked the citric juice as it stung a torn cuticle. I could taste the sunshine and dirt of my mother's garden. I ache to be in her arms now, to bury myself in the cocoa butter creaminess of her soft breasts. Whenever I despaired, I thought of my mother and my grandmother, both of whom had had lives much harder than mine. My mother, Vijaya, was 13 when her mother died. She spent the next 6 years shuttling among family members until she went to college. There she had a boyfriend, whose hand she would hold in secret when they thought no one was looking. But marriage for her, as it was for so many girls in that era, was to be arranged. Her father put an ad in the newspaper that joined countless other pithy summaries, just as they fill many websites and the pages of the Times of India today. These were essentially matrimonial classifieds, with all the efficiency of a Craigslist posting for an old bookcase. My mom's went something like, groom wanted, fair, lovely, college-educated, BSc, 25, 5'4", Tamil Brahmin Iyer girl, seeks alliance with boy of similar and suitable background. Plus, it had her horoscope. Grooms-to-be were advertised with the same specs, complexion, education, age, height, background, caste, and sect. These facts were called biodata. Desperation occasionally shone through these mundane details. In that era, if you spotted the phrase "cast no bar," essentially meaning that any cast would do, then you knew the prospective bride or groom had baggage. A widow with children, for example, couldn't limit herself just to the higher castes. A number of men showed up at the casting calls my grandparents held to inspect possible choices from ads that looked promising. My mother favored a tall, fair, handsome man who showed no fear in the face of her father. Quite the contrary. His cavalier manner included announcing that he belonged to an exclusive private club and peppering the conversation with a smattering of English swear words she had never heard spoken aloud. To my grandfather, this man was insolent. To my mother, he was a rebel. The swaggering opposite of her secret college boyfriend who was too scared to hold her hand in public. Needless to say, my grandfather didn't approve. She won the fight, but my grandfather was right in the end. A year later, they were married, and on the day of the wedding, she saw him, in the bathroom, with his female cousin. At the time, she did nothing. Once we're married and fall in love, she thought, he'll forget about her. My mother was a nurse, well-versed in the bodily aspects of the birds and the bees, but naive about love. Less than a year later, when she found out she was pregnant, her husband dragged her to the doctor, who refused to perform an abortion on a woman so clearly there under duress. I wince now when I think about how I almost wasn't. 25 years later, when I first met my biological father, I asked him to explain himself. He regretted it, he said, but at the time, he didn't want to bring a child into such a troubled marriage. Only after my own marriage revealed itself to be doomed did I understand his inclination, if not his actions. During my mother's pregnancy, they moved into an apartment just a couple of floors above the kissing cousin. He'd often leave my mother home alone, slinking in many hours after work ended and lying about where he'd been. One night, his friend Krishnan dropped by while he was out. Disturbed by the sight of a very pregnant woman left home alone, Krishnan stayed with her for hours. He left when my father finally stumbled home. She confronted him. "Where have you been?" she said. "I told you, I was with Krishnan." I was born in Safdarjung Hospital in New Delhi. My mother endured 36 excruciating hours of labor unmitigated by any epidural. She gave birth in a hospital bed, not at home, as my grandmother had, but otherwise it was as natural as could be. I learned of her long labor from an aunt only a few years ago. Throughout our many rows, my mother never wielded this as a rhetorical weapon. All she ever said was, "Once I saw you, Karna, it didn't hurt at all." My parents were fighting constantly by the time I turned one. My grandfather came to the house to help resolve their disputes. Divorce was anathema to conservative Indian culture then. It barely existed in the cultural vocabulary, religious or otherwise. Most couples stuck out marriage through thick and thin, infidelity and abuse. Yet when he heard my father spit, "Your daughter is ready to lick my boots," my grandfather sided with his daughter over tradition and took her and me back to Delhi. They divorced a year after. Because divorce was so unheard of in middle-class Indian society, people looked at divorcees with a sort of incredulous shock and wonder, as if they were somehow criminals. They were ostracized from everyday life because of an invisible scarlet D hovering over them. Meanwhile, second-wave feminism in the U.S. was changing attitudes about how women were treated in the workplace and in society, and how unmarried women were perceived in particular. Women were challenging age-old notions of their place in the world. Western media was full of unafraid, smart American women who published magazines, were marching in D.C., and were generally making a lot of noise. No such phenomenon had reached our Indian shores. I'm sure my mother had read about the ERA movement, Roe versus Wade, and bra burnings. She, too, wanted the freedom to earn a living in a country where she wouldn't be a pariah because of her marital status. We could have a fighting chance at surviving independently in the United States versus being dependent on her father or a future husband in India. Conservative as he was, my grandfather, K.C. Krishnamurthy, or Tata, as I called him in Tamil, had encouraged her to leave my father after he witnessed how she had been treated. He respected women and loved his daughter, and it must have broken his heart to see the situation she had married into. He, too, wanted us to have a second chance at happiness. America, devoid of an obvious caste system and outright misogyny, seemed to value hard work and the use of one's mind. Even a woman could succeed there. My grandfather was a closet feminist. So when I was two, my mother left India for America. She couldn't afford to bring me with her. She couldn't care for a young daughter while she studied for her local nursing license and worked in a hospital. She would spend the next 2 years diligently working in quiet agony, preparing a life for me. Tata and his second wife, my grandmother Rajima, raised me back home. While my mother prepared a life for us in New York, my grandfather tutored me for that life back in New Delhi. For those 2 years, I would effectively see neither of my parents. My grandmother tells me that long after the other kids had stopped playing and gone inside, I'd sit by the fence that enclosed our building's courtyard in New Delhi. She would call me in and I'd shake my head. When asked what I was waiting for, I'd say, "I'm waiting for my mom to come home from office in Amrikai," pronouncing that last word, Amrikai. In Tamil, my native language, you add the suffix kai to a plant to refer to its vegetable. I didn't know America from bitter gourd. I certainly didn't know it was a place across an ocean. I waited with my grandparents while my mother worked to make a better life for us. She sent for me when I was 4 years old. I finally rejoined my mother on Halloween night in 1974, exactly 2 years to the day after she herself had first deplaned at JFK. She picked me up at the airport wearing a poncho she had knitted. She had a blanket draped over her arm because she feared I would suffer in the New York cold. On the way home, in a cab, we passed many children in costume, witches and clowns and Batman. I thought they were beggars, like the urchins on the streets in Delhi who would dress up and perform for rupees. But there were so many. We reached my mother's apartment at 405 East 83rd Street in Manhattan. Inside the door, I noticed a bowl of candy, which I assumed was for me. But the doorbell kept ringing, and my mother kept handing over my candy to these costumed kids. I was horrified, until she explained the holiday. Amrikai, I thought, a magical place where kids get candy just for dressing up. She gave me a very short tour of her one-bedroom apartment, which was much smaller than my grandparents' home in Delhi. Of course, that didn't matter to me. My mother's presence more than made up for the lack of space. We lay together, cozy in her queen-size bed, under brightly colored covers, and I fell asleep, excited, about candy and clowns, about our new life together. She had sculpted the mist the way those who have no choice do. She had willed a life for the two of us in this new land. My new life brought many changes, a new city, and my mother's new boyfriend, but none as jarring as suddenly being deposited in the land of omnivores. My family members, Brahmins, all of them, were strict vegetarians. In India, a large vegetarian population meant loads of options at restaurants and street stalls. When I arrived in the States, I wouldn't even consider eating meat, despite my mother's pleading. It was the 70s, and meat was considered healthy still. She also wanted her daughter to explore and enjoy the city and its food along with her. The food at these restaurants was either too meaty or too strange for me at the time, and early on it was a struggle to feed me. Of course, she and her boyfriend, a Punjabi cab driver from Queens, couldn't afford to go out and pay for a sitter, so I went out with them too. Dragging a kid along, even well past her bedtime on a weeknight, is squarely within 70s Indian tradition, which claims, disingenuously or not, that routine is not nearly as important as familial togetherness. My mom did make sure that her culinary wanderlust took us exclusively to restaurants that had rice, virtually the only thing I'd eat. And so I became New York's most practiced rice aficionado. At Mañana's on First Avenue, my mom ate tacos as I focused on a heap of red-hued grains and beans. At the Japanese place, near the Russian tea room, where customers sipped soups from small bowls cupped in their hands, I ate rice doused with soy sauce and Tabasco. I liked sitting on the floor and watching all the men struggle to remove their chunky-heeled boots and sit comfortably with their dates. In India, we always sat on the floor at home and took off our shoes before entering the house, so I was perfectly at ease there. At a long-gone Armenian place in the East 40s, I ate pilaf and cucumbers. And whatever I ate, I shoveled into my mouth with my right hand, just as I'd learned to do in India. Except for the occasional flatwood spoon that came with ice cream cups, I had never really used or even been presented with silverware before I got to America. Spoons and forks took me a while to get the hang of. We soon found our groove, though. Namely, we discovered that uniquely American phenomenon, the salad bar. Not only was there a seemingly infinite amount of food, not only was it all food I could eat, canned beets, kidney and garbanzo beans, onions and chutneys, dressings, my mother corrected me, but you could also eat as much of it as you wanted. I'd pile my plate high